Hello and welcome to the Cambi Report, Sam Sullivan Sessions. I'm here with Sam Sullivan, the MLA for Vancouver False Creek. And also, I'm joined by Simon Jackson of Nature Labs. Thank you, Simon, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Nature Labs is an interactive online textbook that is designed to increase children's and other students' availability and accessibility to nature. Also, Simon has the distinct honor of being the first person to call Sam Sullivan a Green Tory. So, Sam, thank you again for agreeing to do this with us.
It's an honor.
So, the thing that we kind of agreed to in terms of what this was going to be was to talk a little bit about Vancouver history, because you are a absolute wealth of knowledge on Vancouver history. Talk about some of the underlying, I would call them like meta-narratives on how development has taken place in this city and how the political divisions and how the kind of planning attitude divisions have shaped the city's growth. And I can't think of a better place to start than streetcars. So we had a very interesting discussion on streetcars. And I think the weirdest thing about it for me was to learn how effectively all our treasured shopping districts were determined by streetcar placement from a company that was headquartered in Britain. So, Sam, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a guy named Robert Horn Payne, disabled guy, who, in a wheelchair, lived in Brentwood. They named Brentwood after where he lived. And he used to run BC Electric. He founded it and ran it. And he was a capitalist. He was successful at getting people to give him a lot of money. And then he invested in Vancouver and Victoria streetcars. And all the decisions of the streetcar, all the placement of the lines were made by Robert Horn Payne in Brentwood from his wheelchair. And nothing else went through without his say-so.
And he was just investing from Britain. Is that the case? Okay. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'll back up just a bit, because I just wanted to get you to the point where I jumped into streetcars and sort of became very fascinated by them. John Punter wrote a book called The Vancouver Achievement. And this is the quintessential book on Vancouver's development. And he said in his first few opening lines that Vancouver has a very unusual model of development called discretionary zoning. And it is the combination of two very, very different forms of development. One is called the British discretionary system, mm-hmm. and the other is the US regulatory system. So you'd think the words discretionary zoning is an oxymoron. You know, these two words should never be in the same sentence, basically. And yet, here we are. We have discretionary zoning. And that comes from our unique history, and that Vancouver, for its first 40-some-odd years, had no planners. There were no government involvement in planning decisions. Even the street system of Vancouver was set out in 1885, the year before the city was started, by a guy named Lachlan Hamilton, mm-hmm. who was an employee of the Canadian Pacific Railway.
Right. He was the one who named all the tree streets and wanted the tree streets to be in alphabetical order, and then went on vacation for a couple of months and came back, and people were like, we have no idea what you were talking about. We've just put them in.
Randomly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know it. And so all the streets were named after, he named them, basically.
Yeah.
So, and here we are in my office on Hamilton Street, you know, so it's kind of fun to think about that connection. So basically the railway company laid out and named all the streets, and the BC Electric streetcar company decided which of those streets would be major.
Okay.
So, you know, Commercial Drive, 4th Avenue, Granville Street, Robson, Davie, Denman. It was actually supposed to be Bidwell was where he was going to put the streetcar line, and the last minute decided to make it Denman. He thought it would be a little bit better placement. So all of these streetcar streets, the streets that we know as our major streets, were laid out by him. So what would happen is that he would put a streetcar down, a line down a street, and then the people who lived on that street with their single-family homes would say, hey, this is kind of neat. There's all these people coming back and forth. I'm going to build a store on the front of my home. Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn my front yard into this big honking store, you know. And there were no rules back then. You right. could do whatever you wanted. It's your private property, and your neighbor has no right to tell you what you can do with that store. So, you know, you'd see one store go up and then another and then a few more, and then suddenly the entire street would have stores in their front lawn. And then they would start demolishing the houses behind. And right. so if you go down to Denman Street and you look over the Japanese, you know, the sushi restaurant, you'll see, if you go back far enough, you'll see two houses right behind the restaurant. And those houses just never got demolished, you know. And there's all over on the major streets of Vancouver, you will see still some stores that have a house still on the property.
I have the distinct pleasure of having lived in one of those houses for the last couple of years.
Wow.
It is a very weird situation, because it's just it's like a store that sells plants and like Laotian tea and bongs, basically, out of my front yard.
That's amazing.
And so we have since moved from there, but it is one of the few places that still had that kind of house and store combination. And it was in one of the unusual places for it, because it's just north of the Punjabi Market. Now, that's an unusual place on Main Street for it, or you know, as it was Westminster, because of how the streetcar lines initially started that housing to commercial space transformation. So generally, the stores on Main stop at 33rd.
Exactly. That's the old streetcar stop.
Yes. And that holds true for Fraser and Victoria and a bunch of others, right?
Yeah, well, Victoria goes up to 43rd, mm-hmm. because that was a streetcar stop, the original one. And then Fraser goes up to 51st, because that was a streetcar stop. So anything up to there was fair game, and people did that. When they extended the streetcar beyond those avenues, mm-hmm. that's when we had zoning. And that was when you needed government permission to convert your front yard into a store. And of course, nobody could get permission. So all of our favorite, loved shopping streets are created by market.
Right.
No government would have even allowed it if they had the chance to do it.
And this is Bartholomew. So what time are we?
Well, that's Bartholomew came in 1928.
Okay. So Harlan Bartholomew was Vancouver's first city planner. And if Harlan Bartholomew had anything to say about it, he would have been Vancouver's only city planner.
Yeah. Well, he was a consultant.
Yes.
So he was brought in 1928, and he was, he was contracted to bring modern ideas to Vancouver. Now, up till then, Vancouver's model was based on London. London is a completely unplanned city. If you look at the street system, you know, they're going all every which way, and nothing seems to make sense. And you see a workshop beside an apartment building, beside a pub, beside an apartment building, beside a home, beside a coffee shop. You know, it's just, it's a planner's nightmare. You know?
Yeah.
And yet it's one of the most favorite cities in the world to go visit. Why? Because it's so interesting. And it hasn't been completely sanitized by guys like Bartholomew. Mm-hmm. Now, Bartholomew was brought in by Vancouver's very first American born and raised mayor. And he wanted to bring in the US system, the regulatory system, the rule-based system. So the discretionary British system says the government can tell you what you cannot build. Mm-hmm. Everything else is possible. The US system, the government tells you what you can build, everything else is not possible. So the US system is very rule-based, very rigid, bureaucrats run everything, mm-hmm. and the British system is very principle-based, and basically it's open and fluid and incremental and organic. And so we went away from that model to the US model with Bartholomew.
So that British style system, the discretionary system, that's what gave us the Sylvia Hotel.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Sylvia? Like,
well, the Sylvia, the Manhattan, all these buildings that were, you know, Bartholomew came and basically said 6 stories maximum. We don't want any of these tall buildings going on. And he wanted to stop apartment buildings. The very first zoning he brought into Vancouver, there was only basically 3 zones. One was for single family homes, one was for apartments, and one was for everything else. And he said, we're trying to stop apartments from invading and infecting the single family areas.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and he very openly promoted it as a way to keep dark people from moving into white neighborhoods. You know, so the zoning system we have in place is very exclusionary.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to stop poor people from, you know, messing up the lives of wealthy people. Now, if you look at Vancouver, the very first wealthy district was Alexander Street, from the very beginning of the city, right beside the Hastings Mill. Alexander, Richard Alexander, the manager, lived right on Alexander Street, of course, and all the wealthy guys lived there. And then suddenly more and more workers and others started to show up, and they decided that they needed to move and get out of from all these poor people. So they all moved to the West End.
Okay.
The West End was full of mansions. That was really the wealthy area. And then as the city grew, more apartments started to be built like the Sylvia and like the Manhattan. Basically, they were in the backyard of a person who had a big mansion. And they said, I think we can make money by building an apartment building in my backyard. And there was no government to tell them no. There was no planners, you know, that's your property. If you own that property, and you think there's a market, go do it.
Right.
And so Sylvia is more than 6 stories tall, which was Harlan Bartholomew came in and said, in the commercial area, you can only have 18 stories. And of course, the marine building's 22 stories, which was got in just before Harlan Bartholomew got his fingers and tentacles onto the planning system. And made it all, you know, totally rigid and very formulaic. So that's how we ended up getting this the U.S. system into Vancouver. And any new streetcar extensions then could not be converted. And he also said all stores that are in the neighborhoods, you know, like we'd have coffee shops and pubs and corner stores. Like when I was a kid in Vancouver, the internal neighborhoods were full of, you know, what we call Chinese stores, because they always seemed to be Chinese people that were, you know, operating and owning it.
Mm-hmm.
So Harlan Bartholomew's law was, if any store or pub or coffee shop or workshop stops operating for 30 days, it cannot be opened again. So over the last 100 years, he's been effective at shutting down all of these places. Now today, there's only about maybe a dozen maximum. You know, the Mighty Oak on, what is it, 18th and Columbia, and,
yeah,
and
the
Marsh St. George.
Federal store at like Quebec and 11th.
Like, yes, kind of, yeah, exactly.
My house.
If you go into Strathcona, you'll find, you know, some of the wilder, you know, there's Benny's, you know, the cafe, and then there's the Union Market. There's just a handful of these places left. And that was what Vancouver used to be full of. And they also said, if you have a retail outlet on a main street, you cannot have workshops, you can't have a laundromat, you cannot, if you do have a restaurant, you can't have singing and dancing. You know, so you can still have a restaurant, but you can't dance. So,
right. So the no fun city
begins then.
begins
exactly.
With Bartholomew. All right.
How does this compare to other places in Canada? Because I mean, what you're saying sounds, I mean, London sounds very similar to how Toronto and Montreal is planned. Vancouver sounds a lot more similar to, say, yeah. Calgary.
Yeah, yeah. So the more recent the city, the more likely it is that you're going to be affected by the U.S. regulatory system. And basically, the U.S. regulatory system came from Germany, Bismarck's Germany. And the U.S. really adopted the German and French system, very rational, you know. Now, if you look at the English garden versus the French or German garden, the English garden always follows the contours of the land and is very natural. The French gardens are whack, you know, they just put these straight lines and geometric shapes and they impose themselves on the, you know, on the environment. Another example is the law system. You know, European law is very much statute oriented. The Roman law, the civil code, the Napoleonic code, dictated and decreed by government. The British law is common law, where judges try to feel out what is the ancient system of morality in the community, and they, by very incremental steps, build up this whole body of law called common law. So it's very deep in the culture. You know, Adam Smith is this is where we get into talk about emergentists. So the British had this really strong strain of philosophy called the emergentists. Alan Turing was one of the great emergentist philosophers, one of the inventors of the computer. And basically, the computer was a great example of emerging properties, where you'd have, like, say if you have polyps, little tiny sea creatures, if you have billions of them together, they make coral reefs. You know, these are tiny little creatures. And when you see starlings fly, it's one thing to see them individually, but when you see them in millions, they make these beautiful geometric shapes, which are all based on emergent property of their flying.
The murmurations.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is actually kind of stemming from a principle in biology that it is a theory, so it hasn't, you know, specifically been proven, but I like the idea, and I find it very hopeful, that the more energy you pour into a system, the natural response of the system is to increase complexity. So, you know, in terms of what that means for Earth, that means that the more energy that we keep pouring into the system from the sun, because it has no ability to leave because of our ozone layer and because of the trapped carbon in the atmosphere, it allows for complexity to generate itself because that energy wants to find some way to go somewhere. And if that goes into building a more complex system, then it can find a resting place where it can not just, like, you know, entropically contribute to the heat death of the universe.
Well, that's what they say about emergent properties, is that order constructs itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that life is an example of an emergent property. You know, get a bunch of rocks and you leave them for a billion years and you dump sunshine in for a long time. Eventually you get humans and giraffes and things like that. And consciousness is also an emergent property. No one would ever predict that this brain would actually emerge from it consciousness. And so they say that cities are very complex, and economies are very complex. Those are the two most complex human systems. And economies, it turns out, are better when they're not planned, when the market constructs itself. And we've seen examples where the Soviet Union went in 1928, and Stalin brought it through what they called the Veliki Pavorot, which is the great turn to planning, where they said, we're going to get smart people to run our economy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how many decades later, the whole thing collapsed under the weight of the planners that just couldn't keep up. You know, they were trying to, okay, I'm going to need 500 left-handed screws show up there and a bunch of long sheets of metal, and that has to end up there at this time. And, you know, these guys were trying to intentionally find enough materials for a car or whatever, and they would end up just creating a disaster. And so the whole communist or planned system basically imploded. And it's interesting that Vancouver had its own Veliki Pavorot in 1928, the same year that Stalin came along and brought planning to Soviet Union. Harlan Bartholomew showed up in Vancouver, and we got our own Veliki Pavorot, where we got Soviet-style planning system. And what they found in normal cities that are very market-driven and very, very organic is that they all have this very classic density gradient.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very distinctive density gradient. It starts from the middle and it goes out, and you can actually calculate its formula mathematically.
So this is something that we will link in the show notes, but it is a fascinating thing that takes the size, it basically chops up Vancouver or chops up any city into its individual block parts, and then graphs them against the amount of people living in them.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cities, it follows a very clear trend from high density to low density in terms of like the amount of places that are being occupied by high density housing and the amount of places that are being occupied by low density housing. Vancouver's graph is bananas.
Yeah, it's like, Soviet cities are very weird. They do not have this density gradient. They sort of have it on the outside, but in the central area with all the government where there was no market to help to divide things up, it's really weird. And then the weirdest city is Brasilia. If you look at their density gradient, there's no density gradient. It's all over the place, you know. It's up and down and up and down. There is no real organic thing that happened there. And so what they found is when the United Nations creates a refugee camp, they will set up all the tents and all the buildings in a certain way. And the people will come in, they'll start to move them. Because people have their own sense of how a city should be, how people should live, and what the right dimensions are. And Burning Man is a great example of how over time the city that gets built in a day or whatever, that's developed its own very distinctive pattern and dimensions. And so people actually can construct their own city without the help of planners.
Right.
So the idea is planners are needed to get the streets and the parks and all the public places, and then they should get out of the way. Because every time they put their sticky fingers into things, they mess it up. And that's one example is what Harlan Bartholomew did. He came to Vancouver and he said, hardly anybody has cars around here. This is so interesting. But then he sanitized all the neighborhoods so no one could get things anymore, be down the street. Oh, I've got, you know, the Jane's got a little laundromat down in a couple of stores, a couple of houses away, and I can always go down for coffee to Jim's place because he set up a little coffee shop, and you know, all these things were so easy to, they could get anything what they wanted within their own neighborhood. And then when Bartholomew came and sanitized all of the city, basically everybody had to get a car because they had to now drive to destination places to get their services and goods.
So one of the things that I remember you saying was that Vancouver's planning system is a compromise between a American style Bartholomew type plan and the British style of permissive zoning or discretionary zoning. How has that come about, or like what, how did that end up marrying the two concepts? Basically, okay. Where did we go from Bartholomew?
So I'll have to back up. I was telling you about the wealthy people living on Alexander Street. They all went to the West End, and then all the poor people started kind of moving in, and you know, all this activity. And so they all left and moved to Shaughnessy. But they said, hey, we've already moved twice now. There's no way we want to have to move again. So they went to the provincial government and got the very first zoning in British Columbia and possibly in Canada. 1914, called the Shaughnessy Heights Settlement Act, where it said you can only have large single-family homes in this area and you can't do anything else. That's why anything past 16th Avenue on Granville, there's no commercial. You won't find it until you get out of Shaughnessy.
Right, it's all hedges.
yeah, exactly. So that was the very first zoning. So really, zoning was created by wealthy people who wanted to stop being, you know, displaced by poor people. Because when poor people and wealthy people go head to head, the poor people always win. They say the rich people always win. No, that's only in a certain rare cases when they outbid poor people with their prices. What the poorer people do is they outbid with less consumption. So they agree to consume less. And so it's always easier for people who don't have a lot of money to outbid the wealthy people, unless you can put minimum standards. So you have to have, like Bartholomew said, you have to have a 40-foot lot frontage. Anything less than 40 feet, you had to get permission. So that he forced large lots and single-family homes in all of the city. And basically, he drew lines around where we were in 1928, and those lines have not changed in 100 years. Exactly the same. And what he did was he made sure that any growth had to be in a single family form, and you just keep going further and further out, and suddenly all of the American cities are just sprawl, all forced on that by zoning, by exclusionary processes that were meant originally to keep poor people and, as he called them, colored people out of finer residential neighborhoods. Quote from him.
Yeah, I often find that when you look at bad decisions of the past, what was motivating them? Was it racism? It's often racism, but
classism.
Yes. So, like, we haven't changed in 100 years, and
okay, so that's the next phase.
Okay.
So this guy named Fred Hume, great grandson of a royal engineer. Royal engineers came to British Columbia to stop the U.S. from takeover, and then Fred Hume sees. Basically, the U.S. has taken over. It's taken over our culture. It's taken over our development processes. I want to find someone who is more aware of the British system of development, the organic, the London model, where things are more organic and incremental. So he finds a guy named Gerald Sutton Brown, born and raised in Jamaica, educated in the University of Southampton, worked in all these British cities, gets the British model. They bring him over to Vancouver, and he then marries these two models, the U.S. regulatory system, which all the wealthy people loved because it kept poor people out, and then he brought in the discretionary system. And where he was most effective was in the West End. So there's no equivalent to the West End in all of the U.S. cities, say the West Coast. That is like wild. When I lived in the West End, I lived in a tower, right beside a single family home, right beside a three-story walk-up, beside another single family home, beside a tower, beside a six-story. It's just this cacophony of crazy, different forms. Yeah, very exciting, very interesting, totally chaotic. And the other thing he really wanted was to keep density off of the main streets. And sure enough, you go in the West End, this very dense neighborhood, and you find one-story commercial buildings. Now, it goes totally against what we do now, because there was a backlash against Gerald Sutton Brown and his British model. And they say now the only place you can put density is on the worst unlivable places, on the arterial. And the arterial housing is supposed to be buffer housing. It's supposed to buffer the pollution and the noise and the dust and all the smells to protect the really good people, the guys that live in single family homes behind that area.
Right.
So that's to give you an example of how it's completely turned Gerald Sutton Brown's system on his head. But he brought in discretionary zoning. And for example, the Vancouver Special was an example where he did not want to influence the design of buildings. So the Vancouver Special was really an example of him. The other thing that he did was he allowed signage, especially when a street became very interested in signage, like Granville Street in Chinatown. We had neon lights all over the place in Granville Street and Chinatown. We had the second highest density of neon lights in the world. Mm-hmm. And then when the backlash came against him, they brought in a sign bylaw. This was a team. And they got rid of all this neon signs. They stopped the West End. They took out the Vancouver Special and made it illegal, and basically went back to the Harlan Bartholomew model.
So this would have been, now we've all been talking about these kind of periods in Vancouver's history. The first part where there was no zoning, the Bartholomew era, the Sutton Brown era. And now we enter a period that I think is very shrouded in a lot of myth, and that is the team era through to the present. So this is a period that began with the election of team in 72. Is that
70? Well, late 72. Yeah. Dick Bauer in 73.
And then continues effectively to the present day.
Exactly. Yeah, we are in the shadow of team. We are the team model.
So I wanna start talking about team in part by talking about one of the major myths about how TEAM came in and why TEAM came in, and that is that freeway plan. So most people, if I would ask them, and they have some kind of familiarity with Vancouver civic politics, if I asked them what stopped the freeway, they would tell me the election of TEAM in 72. And the most fascinating thing that I think we had a chance of talking, that, like, I will confess that I believe this as well, was that this is absolutely not the case at all. So you've been doing some digging in the archives. You've taken a look at both the 72 election material and also the period that the freeway system was proposed and eventually halted. So why don't we back up to the beginning of the freeway era and start there. Sure. So we have some consequences from everyone having to have a car.
Okay, so what the very first freeway plan was by Harlan Bartholomew. And he recognized that he was going to create all the sprawl and that you were going to need to find some way to get people in and out of the downtown. So he called it a distributor connector in 1928. The word freeway was coined in 1930. So before we even had the word, he drew it out, you know, basically a 200-foot wide thing that would basically, it would go down from Burrard, down Pacific, down Homer Street, and go out to Pender. And then there would be another, they would widen Robson, and it would go straight down and out. And they'd build a new bridge over the Falls Creek, and it would go out Kingsway. So that was the distributor connector. And that was Harlan Bartholomew. And so everybody thought, okay, we need a freeway. You know, we want to be a good U.S.-type modern city. We need freeways. And I got to say, Gerald Sutton Brown bought into that, too. You know, he said, okay, this is what I've inherited. This is where we're going. So he started negotiating with the provincial government, and they wanted a southern model. They wanted a southern freeway down on the south side of the city, well, 16th Avenue and then up Granville Street, etc.
Now, were the cities merged at this time? Were like the
yes,
south
Harlan Bartholomew was part of that merge.
Okay.
Merger, 1929, basically.
Okay. Just for some context, there were effectively three cities of Vancouver. Go check out Sam's fantastic video on Cumtux, the YouTube channel KUMTUKX.
Oh, thank you. S, yeah. Yeah, so Vancouver was three cities. They merged them all in 1929. And so, but eventually the provincial government said, we're out of it. You know, this was the era of Phil Gillardy and W.A.C. Bennett, and there's no way he was going to pay for a city road.
Right.
He said, you're on your own. And so the city recognized that they couldn't do it on their own. They needed another funding source. In steps the federal government. Jack Austin wants a third crossing to the North Shore. And so he says, look, come on with us. We will pay for your freeway. But it has to go on the north side, and it has to somehow get a connector up to the third crossing on Burrard Inlet. So in order to do that, they had to change everything, and then there had to be this connector that would go, and original idea was either Carroll Street or Gore Street, and that caused a, you know, really big problem, you know. And Gerald Sutton Brown was always focused on, how are we going to pay for this? So he needed a new Georgia Street viaduct. The thing was literally about to fall down. So they said, we'll pay for it federally if you make it big enough to take a freeway. So he said, okay, you know, and then we will pay for upgrading of your housing in Strathcona if you have the freeway close enough to it that it will justify us putting more money into that. So it was really a fundraising effort for him to sort of max out federal dollars. What it ended up doing was really pissed everybody off. 1967, there was a unanimous vote of council to allow a Chinatown freeway. Mm-hmm. Even Harry Rankin voted for it. He later apologized. But eventually, in first meeting in 1968, they nixed that and said no more. So the freeway did exist as a plan for a few months, 2 or 3 months. And then it was killed.
So
and
this is October 67 to January 68.
Yeah, that point there was an official freeway plan. Then council rescinded its motion in January 68, and basically the freeway died. They did keep talking about it, and so the city in 1969 did agree that it would allow a third crossing to go underground down Thurlow and pop up on Great Drake and Pacific and follow around where what is now Pacific Boulevard and go out the Georgia Viaduct. But they wouldn't pay anything toward it. The feds came in 67 and said, we're out of it. We're not funding anymore. So with no provincial funding, no federal funding, in 1968, basically, 1967, the fall, the freeway died. There was no funder. The city said they're not putting any money into it. The province and the federal government said we're not putting into any money. And so they did talk about it, and there was some efforts to revive it for several years. But the critical thing that I found and I was shocked at is the 1972 campaign had no talk about the freeway. It didn't even come up. And the team commitment platform had 10 items, and none of them mentioned the freeway. So, you know, there are people in the city who swear that the freeway, you know, the 72 campaign was about the freeway. Mm-hmm. And yet it was never mentioned in any of the articles. It was never in the platform. The freeway was long dead years earlier.
It actually, like, to me, speaks to one of the strengths of how democracy doesn't stop at an election. Like, democracy is an ongoing thing that allows for citizen engagement to actually come and respond to the actions of government and, in this particular case, change them. The 1972 campaign, like, there would have been a... Would there not have been another campaign in 1969, if I'm...
Yeah, well, there were several campaigns before then.
Okay.
And it was all, they talked about the freeway, and the freeway proponents always won.
Right,
you
okay.
know? So, you know, this
even
is...
after the freeway had been killed in...
Yeah. Tom Campbell was left power in 72, you know, with the campaign, he left. And then Gerald Sutton Brown was fired in 73. So these were all, you know... Freeway proponents, original proponents, were still in power well after that.
So 72 happens, and what is that campaign fought over?
It's mostly about the West End.
Okay.
So that was quite a shocker to me too. So there was a big fight to see who would stop the West End and degrade it and denigrate it the fastest and the most loudest, you know, So the more left-wing you were, the more you wanted to stop it now.
Mm-hmm.
Team said, we will allow for the already existing, approved buildings to be built, and then we'll stop it. And then the NPA said, look, it's a market. You know, we'll allow it to keep going. We'll allow density if it's in the market interest. So when Team came in, up to that point, there was about 250 residential towers built in Vancouver. From 73 on, for the next decade, there were 15. You know, so 250 in the first that decade, and zero basically approved in the next decade. So the building of residential and rental apartments ended in 1973. A couple of other things ended in 1973. Team took all the way to the Supreme Court Shannon Mews, because they attempted to build townhouses on the west side of Vancouver, which was an outrage for many people.
Right. This Imagine. Is the lands around Jericho, right? Is this,
no, up on Granville 50th area.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that was considered a big no-no to allow townhouses in Vancouver
right.
under team government. So as of that, they took them all the way to the Supreme Court and won. And got them to be non-conforming, so it was really hurt them economically. And after that, for decades, no one ever built townhouses in Vancouver. And, so team was effective at that way. The other thing they did shortly after, is they started an initiative on single-family homes to stop the Vancouver Special, which they considered also an outrage. The other thing they did was they started going after SROs. So at that point, there had been 13,000 SROs in the city. Team, in its first 3 years, took out over 2,000. They were able to shut them down. And there was about three different surges of shutting down low-income SRO-type housing. So today, we only have about half the number that we had under Sutton Brown.
Now, this is the period, maybe a little later than that, but when the Sahota started buying up into, it was like the 80s when the Sahota started buying up from the SROs that were like being mandatorily sold off. And
yeah, I'm not sure about that history. I haven't got that far. Okay. I'm just up to the 1970s. So
all right.
You're way ahead of me. But what I can tell you is that the other thing they brought in 74 was the sign bylaw. They got rid of all the neon signs in Vancouver. They really doubled down on making the zoning very rigid and strict. And that was when bureaucratic power really took off. And it, you know, they would do everything like, what was the angle of your roof? How many inches overhang? You know, it became very, very strict, totally run by bureaucrats. And the market was basically not allowed to function, which is where we are now with house prices.
Right.
When you restrict innovation and density and the market, you are restricting supply. And what happens is prices go up. So I think we're at a tipping point where we may just overthrow the U.S. system and bring back the British system, the organic, the incremental, the innovative system, where you'd actually have buildings that are thought through and not just dictated by some sort of bureaucrat who's drawn a bunch of lines and said, this is how it has to be. So I'm hoping by telling this story, we're going to get a real revolution in going back to the way we actually used to do things when Vancouver was a very interesting, fun city.
So what does that look like? And, you know, I know we had a discussion on election night talking about how there were two fourth wave parties on the ballot, neither of which managed to elect anyone, mind you. But as you said then, as suggested then, the revolution is scheduled for the next election.
Yes. So what I've noticed is that every 50 years, there's a revolution.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So I've done some videos on this, the three waves of urban reform. 1860s, basically 1867, when the federal government gives the responsibilities to the provinces. And so then you got basically democracy and a very structured, very, you know, very minimalist but primitive structure for city governments. Mm-hmm. And then the democratic process that was created was so corrupt and inefficient and incompetent that in 1910s they started bringing in this progressive movement where you got basically civil servants, experts, professionals, and they really improved the system a lot. And one of their recommendations from the progressive movement was to get away from the ward system, to go to an at-large system, and to go to an executive mayor, which we had at one point, but don't anymore. We've gone back to the
U.S. mayor, council.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then in the 60s came the next wave. 60s, really, it really hit in 73. That was when it really hit shore, that wave, and that was the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was opposed to Western values, Western civilization, Western law, etc. And it really was it was a suburban revolution, really. And so here we have, well, 50 years from 1973, gee, that's 2023. That's coming up, you know. I think we're going to have a revolution in 2023. I mean, we saw the first sort of, you know, seismic event with the last election where people who actually wanted innovation, who wanted market forces, who wanted incrementalism and innovation, they took a run at city government and failed. But the forces are keep building.
Mm-hmm.
And younger people are getting more savvy and into government. We're having the tech industry come along, and they don't believe in this rigid stuff that the baby boomers were all about. And they may just succeed in throwing out the U.S. system and bringing back the U.K. system of development.
Well, from a perspective of contemporary political analysis, it has created some tremendous splits within both the left and the right in Vancouver.
Mm.
And, you know, by all means, if you're not comfortable commenting on this, just wave me away and then I'll edit that out. But like there have been people who have been opposed on council to development. And one of the things that really struck me about this sort of theory of urban reform in Vancouver is the phrase, "That which feels green was green."
Exactly.
And I might even extend that to "that which feels just is just."
Yeah.
There has been a opposition to building more housing, particularly from Councillor Hardwick and Councillor Swanson, the left and right of the council, arguably.
Yeah.
And a particular support of social housing, or in general more housing development, from younger members of council, in particular Councillor Weeb and Councillor Dominato and Councillor DiGenova.
Yeah, you see the younger people going for more innovation, more allowing the pressures to be, you know, exemplified and demonstrated through building. So, you know, I mean, the Green Party, I call them the Urban Conservative Party, basically. I'm not sure what Michael Weeb's doing there, but, you know, he's a business guy, he's a young guy who understands, you know, the need for more housing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the Green Party is probably the worst in terms of voting against new housing and wanting to go to these old rigid models that are completely outdated. And you know, it's the worst environmental model of living that you could imagine, you know, the single detached home,
mm-hmm.
basically. So we're seeing other councillors perhaps starting to, you know, move that direction. And you may find a complete realignment in the next little while as the younger people who are getting, you know, really abused by the current system and the system that's built up over the last 50, 60, 70 years, they're going to be the ones that are going to be trying to turn it around and allow for a more successful city.
Now, as we know from looking at revolutions of the past, everything is up for grabs. What can people do? What do you see as the options, both good and bad, from a possible fourth revolution in urban reform? And then what can people do if they want to help bring one about?
Well, first of all, you have to have an awareness of what's happened, how we got here. So I'm trying to tell that story right now and to see that this is a pendulum swing and that we really, you know, I mean, we are British Columbia. We really should be supporting the British organic discretionary model, the London-based model. You know, we'd rather, you know, the city that Harlan Bartholomew planned just before he got to Vancouver was Peoria, Illinois. So we sacrificed the London model for the Peoria model. Peoria is our model. That's what we want. That's where
every
we're going.
Vancouverite's dream.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So do you want to be London or do you want to be Peoria? I think that's the question we need to ask, and that needs to be the ballot question. You know, let's have a more exciting, innovative city. And, you know, like people say, no, why do we have to have density? And, you know, it's funny that in British Columbia, 99.9% of the British Columbia, you could move there and never worry about anybody ever getting in, you know, offending you by building something near you. There's only like 0.1% where the citizens and the governments have invested $100 billion of transportation and infrastructure. And some people just chose that 0.1% of the property of British Columbia and decided they want to be left alone. Like, this is a really bad idea. You know, you can't just set up your tent beside $100 billion worth of assets. This is a city, you know. If you want to be by yourself and you don't want anybody to bother you, there are a lot of nice small towns.
Sparwood is there for you.
Perfect. <It's> like... Please, be my guest, you know. And let's let Vancouver be a city.
Right. Okay. So the what we had kind of called the two fourth wave parties were Coalition Vancouver and Yes Vancouver. So why would you call Coalition Vancouver, which was I think a reaction to what is happening right now, why would you call them fourth wave?
So I don't even know who they were. Tell me who they were.
It's Wei Young and a kind of reaction against a, particularly with a lot of immigrant community support in particular, but it is a reaction against the planning of vision in particular.
Mm. Well, I think they were anti-density, weren't they?
In general, yes. Yeah. But I see them more as like a reactionary anti-planning party.
Hmm.
As compared to Yes Vancouver, which is also a kind of reactionary anti-planning party, but in so much as they think that we should stop planning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so Gerald Sutton Brown wanted a new model. He wanted discretionary zoning.
Mm-hmm.
He said there are some valid and very important aspects of planning, and there are really important aspects of discretionary non-planning. You can let the system construct itself and get out of the way. And he said planners have to be very careful to know when to keep their fingers out of things. They need to be there for the public spaces for sure. And they need to moderate and mediate, you know, as change happens to make sure that, you know, people aren't really harmed by it. So we used to have a system called, when Harlan Bartholomew came in, they set up a system called the Zoning Board of Appeal. It was a committee. And that was anybody who didn't like what they were getting from the officials, they could go to the Zoning Board of Appeal and they could ask for their zoning, their you know, what they wanted to build. And Harlan Bartholomew hated it. He kept going to try to stop the Zoning Board of Appeal. He said, let's get more people on it so it will water it down. And let's also change the name to the Board of Variance. And he was successful. So that Zoning Board of Appeal that used to be the release valve that would allow development to happen got completely neutered. And it's now called this Zoning Board of Variance. And even though the terms of reference haven't changed, people still could use that. And I think if you were to resource that board and change the name back to the Zoning Board of Appeal, you could actually get some really interesting stuff happen that judges would look at every proposal and would then decide yes or no based on being reasonable, not based on some ancient law that was written by some guy in 1928.
Right, you get an objective standard, the reasonableness standard.
Okay. Reasonable. So it would be more of a British common law type of model where they would try to feel their way around, you know, getting change to neighborhoods.
There's one final thing that I wanted to touch on, and that was the fact that history is always up for grabs. And in particular, a housing development in Dunbar that we had a chance to talk about a couple of times ago, and how this changed the election, where you didn't end up running, you didn't win the NPA nomination for mayor again. Because I think the perception of that series of events and the actual sense of how that played out are very distinct. So can you tell us a little bit about that, like how that particular proposal for affordable housing in Dunbar changed effectively Vancouver's history?
Well, I don't think it was just that. I mean, I had support from all of my caucus, except one, you know, who decided he wanted to be the mayor. And,
right.
And one other caucus member in the park board. But all the other school and park all supported me. Many of them felt I got them elected. You know, we came from two seats and a minority in all the committees and took back all of the committees. Or NPA, and we had a very collegial program where we would all vote together. You know, we would come up with solutions. Many of them I didn't like, but I always, you know, submerged my own interest to the group. We would have votes, and whatever the majority of our caucus decided, we would go with it. And we'd have a chance to really talk it through. So, but I did support social housing in Dunbar on the 16th, and this was a big problem for a lot of people who are core voters. And many people didn't like my drug policy, which was the British model, which is it's an issue between the doctor and the patient. and the doctor should be able to prescribe, you know, anything that they think they need to basically kill the organized crime, you know. And so instead we went to the U.S. model. It's very rigid, very rule-based. You can't do drugs, you know. If you do, you're going to jail, or we're going to really treat you badly, you know. So that's a complete overthrow of the U.K. system of incrementalism and organicness and allowing things to go where they seem to need to go. So, and then the other one was ecodensity. Of course, people didn't like the idea of density. You know, I call it ecodensity because eco stood for ecology and economy. You know, I wanted to get control of house prices, which in 2005 I thought were way too high. And I wanted to get control of drug overdoses, which in 2005 were up to 100 per year, which I thought were way too high.
Well, thank God we've solved that problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you can tell, I failed spectacularly on both of those. I never got a chance to get into my second term where we were going to do all the changes because I had to retire from city council, or as my wife helpfully reminds me, I was thrown out of my party and never did get a chance to get control of house prices and get control of overdose deaths.
So, like, I just find it so interesting that, like, the reaction of, like, core MPA voters found a candidate that had effectively, I think Peter Ladner was perceived as being to your left by at least the general voting populace. And whether or not that's actually true is, you know, neither here nor there. I just think it's interesting to think about how he managed to parlay a opposition to social housing and an opposition to the drug policy amongst MPA core voters, and then present himself as a more left-wing manifestation of, you know, an NPA that was interested in moving forward in the city. So I thought that was a bit fascinating.
Yeah, it's almost like we don't have the right words and the right descriptions to even to talk about it, you know, because I wanted to, you know, give free drugs to addicts and, you know, allow the market to work and density, which is, seems to me like a, I guess you call it a right-wing thing. I don't know if you...
So yeah,
free market.
It's almost like there is no clear way to fit a left-right political spectrum onto the issues of this city, which my colleague Ian has been talking about for a while. But this sort of second dimension, which he's calling, you know, density or NIMBY versus conservationist, it has existed before. It has existed in, you know, the reaction of Vancouver to drug policy and the reaction of Vancouver to high-rise buildings. And it might not actually be a new dimension at all.
Huh, interesting, yeah.
Well, any final words? Anything else that you think would be interesting?
No, I'm so glad you're interested, and I hope people really pay attention to this next election coming up. And, you know... I think the revolution may be coming.
All right. Well, stay tuned for the revolution. Thank you so much, Sam. It has been fascinating talking with you today. Good day.